Bin ich wieder da. Ist gut. Irgendwie riecht der Tee sehr, sehr gut. Irgendein Tee riecht hier unheimlich gut. Yogi-Tee? So ein Weihnachtstee oder was? Ist lecker. Ah, ich habe beide. Hab den gleich. Ja. Super lecker. Mal gucken, wo der Gui rumsteckt. Das hat sich verdrückt. Okay, wollen wir mal weitermachen, oder? Okay, so. Maybe I should first, yeah, soll ich mal noch was dazu sagen, Niklas? Yeah? Okay, so there was a question. Actually, this is something that may cause some confusion. Because what you do is, suppose you have some L, okay? Let's say L0. Okay, and then you start to compute an H0 from Legendre transformation. I do it for the scalar case because it always works the same. Pi phi dot minus L0. And then in the partition function, you have somehow pi phi dot minus H0. Okay? Something like this. And you say, oh, wait a second. If I just use this formula for H0 here, I would immediately conclude this is L0, right? So then there is no more pi. I can just forget about the pi. The pi integral is some infinite constant that I don't care about. And I get immediately to the result, after some steps, I immediately get to this result here. Why can you not do this? Why is this not allowed? Yeah.
But I would say that you have to change the phi dot in L to the pi.
The phi dot in L to the pi.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Then you cannot do this, yeah, okay. So you would say, here I have already replaced phi dot with pi. Okay, in the scalar case this works. Exactly like this, no? And then you have changed it here, but there's still a phi dot here, no? And then you would still have to integrate over both, you say? Yeah, but this is not the same, no? Obviously.
Why?
Because there is still an e to the minus 1/2 pi squared, no? When you do this, no? We did this calculation.
No.
We did this calculation. We computed this here. We computed this here.
But the phi dot from the left will then cancel this part.
This is minus 1/2 pi squared. Actually, it's pi minus phi dot squared minus plus L0. This is what comes out when you do this. It's not this here. Some pi prime here. No? So the point is, this is classical. No? This is classical. Because you use classical identities between pi and phi. No? This is a classical identity here. But in this formalism, pi is an independent variable. Has nothing to do with this here. I cannot simply write phi dot squared here. It's not possible. No. When you make this step here, yeah, you go to the quantum world. so to speak. And then you cannot just use the classical relations between phi and pi. So that's why the order you do this is very important. This step is also classical. This is a Legendre transforms. Everything is classical. But you have to start from this formula, because this is what you derived from the transition amplitude. And here, these guys are not related by any argument on the classical level. Maybe at the stationary point of this thing, where you argue the stationary point is the classical limit, where the equations of motion work, there you can do this. But you cannot just eliminate. You have to do it properly. Yeah? You have to do this quadratic completion. Then you get this. And here there's no pi. There's just phi and phi dot, gradient phi. OK? So you have to really factor out this integral over pi. So I don't know whether this answers this. Probably not. You had some other idea. OK, good. We talk more. At least this is how I thought this needs to be done. That's how I clarified it for myself many years ago. Okay. Good. So one has to be careful where you stop working with classical assumptions and where you enter the quantum field theoretical application. Okay, good. So now the final step is to compute this determinant there. No? And this is very simple. No? So you can... So if you can find... So I think this is on the level of a theorem. Okay. So suppose we have projection operators, which I call PI. I goes from 1 to n onto one-dimensional subspaces. Subspaces in n dimensions. So projection operator means if I take two of the guys, they must be orthogonal and idempotent. So this is the idempotency and the orthogonality. And they have to be complete. So the sum over all the projection operators must give you the n times n unit matrix. Okay, so then the determinant of a polynomial in these projection operators, A, I are just some real valued numbers. Okay, they can be complex valued, but these are numbers, C numbers. Okay, let's call them classical C number. This is simply the product over all the AIs. No? I think this works. Probably you can find it somewhere in the mathematical literature. And the proof is, of course, I hope I didn't make any mistake proving this. So first of all, you find a basis where the projection operator looks like follows, where the PI is, okay, it's basically zero almost everywhere except for the ith row and column in the diagonal. So we have, it must be an n by n, sorry, so this is I, this is 1, this is n. 1, n. Okay. This is not necessarily the same projection operator, so let me call it P twiddle. Yeah? Okay, and if you have for real matrices, you can find this basis by an orthogonal transformation. Yeah? Okay. So then, then the original determinant is simply determined. So I multiply this by O from the left and O transverse from the right. And then instead of the P, I have the PI twiddle. No? And then, of course, you use the well-known fact that determinant A times B is determinant A times determinant B. Okay, but obviously these guys cancel, eh? Because here I can use again determinant O, O transpose is 1. Because I can also use this factor here and then take reverse this, that O, or maybe I could use some cyclicity property under the determinant, whatever you call this. At least they will cancel. And what is this guy here? Eh? This basically, if you look at this basis, is A1 is here, A2, A3, A4. So all the real coefficients appear in the main diagonal. So this is then basically just a product over the AIs. Okay, that's it, no? Okay. So this is very simplistic proof of this, theorem up there. Of course, I want to apply this to this matrix down here. And we introduce these well-known projection operators. So the unit matrix is basically, I rewrite this by adding and subtracting a term. And this thing here is the projection operator transverse to K mu, and this is the projection operator parallel to K mu. No? So this is not the one-dimensional subspace, but a three-dimensional subspace, okay. But at least I still have these two projection operators, which form a complete basis, so to speak, in the sense of the completeness relation here. Should I have said this is completeness? Okay. And you can also show that they're idempotent. I think we did this. We showed that those are idempotent and orthogonal. Okay. Well known from last year's lecture. Okay. And then, in principle, you can apply this proof with a small variant. Naja, good. Okay. So I can just explicitly compute. Don't need to use this. Since this proof was for one-dimensional subspace projectors onto one-dimensional space, it's a little bit. It's not directly applicable, but you can also just do the calculation directly. as you will see. So in principle, I did not need this theorem, but it's of course suggestive of the way to solve this problem. It suggests a way to solve this problem. So I compute this determinant now using the projector. I just copy, no? Just I just insert g mu nu is p per plus p parallel. So this was one term missing from the g mu nu. Yeah? This was basically the, now I've erased it. Ah, no, here it is. OK. No, sorry. No, this was just identity. So the term you remember, no? There was basically g mu nu times this factor, and then minus 1 minus lambda k mu k nu over t squared. OK. And t squared I still have, but this is basically k mu k nu over k squared. So I have to multiply with k squared over t squared to get the original formula back. And these two terms, this plus this, gives the old g mu nu. Okay. I think this is clear, is it? More or less? Yeah, no? Okay. And now you have, you remember this theorem, no? So this is a three space projector. Okay. Not a one space projector here. But the coefficient in front of all three, how to say? So the coefficient is the same for the complete three space. So in principle, I could now go to one space projectors, but they would all have the same coefficient. A1, A equal A2, equal A3, this coefficient. So you basically get this A1, A2, A3, which is the same coefficient, EK squared minus K0 squared over T squared. You get this three times. So you get this, you get something up to signs, because there's still this minus sign here and this minus sign here, up to signs. You get this coefficient three times, e k squared minus k zero squared over t squared to the power 3. Yeah? Using this argument here, no? And you get 1 times this factor here. No? This is the A4, if you like, for the final projector, which spans the four-dimensional subspace. OK. So here we use this theorem, so to speak. OK? Is this clear? Yeah. If you think that I should have done one space projector, three of them, it's not really necessary. They all have the same, in this decomposition, they all have the same coefficient. I know it must appear 3 times to the power 3, yeah, according to this theorem. And the one space projector here, the p parallel, that coefficient is just this one. Okay? So no problem. Okay, good. So I just manipulate this a little bit here. You see what comes out. This, of course, is minus k0 squared plus k squared plus m squared. No? This is about minus k squared plus m squared, yeah? four vector k squared. Plus 1 minus lambda k squared. Ooh. Okay. Cancelled. So the whole thing is m squared divided by lambda minus k squared over t squared times lambda. Obviously, ne? Ah, good. So in principle, I can also write this again as k0 squared minus k vector squared, like in this form. Ne? And I define an ek comma lambda squared, where this guy is k vector squared plus m squared over lambda. This is the energy, the dispersion relation of a particle with mass m over square root of lambda. Very good. So now I put everything together up to some irrelevant constants. Yeah. I could write it like this, but it's up to the constant equal. So remember, there was always a product of a momentum space that we didn't get rid of. Then, remember, there was infinitely many powers of square root of lambda from the pi 0 prime integral. Okay, this is what we had. Then, then we have this whole thing here to the power minus 1/2, right? Determinant to the power minus 1/2 from the Gaussian integral. So this thing to the power minus 1/2 is e k squared minus k0 squared over t squared to the power minus 3/2. And then this guy here to the power minus 1/2, ne? E k lambda squared minus k0 squared over t squared to the power minus 1/2. And another lambda to the minus 1/2. Ne? So, good. I hope you're as happy as I am. Oops.
Wasser ist aber heute nicht so gut.
So. Okay, because now you see, this cancels. This was the whole reason why we did this exercise. Ne? If you drop the pi integral immediately, you worry about this factor here. Ne? And you would not get, or in other words, you would not get this dispersion relation, but you would get extra factors of lambda in front of momentum and energy, which we don't know what to do about. When you send lambda to zero at the end of the day, right? I mean, you would have only the mass term would survive, so m squared over t squared, but that's somehow stupid. What does an m squared over t squared mean in terms of thermodynamical partition function? You need always this stuff here, ne, to pick up the pole. When you do the Matsubara sum, you want to pick up the pole at plus minus ek, or actually plus or minus ek. Yeah? But if there's no k0, you do the Matsubara sum with an m squared. It's an infinite contribution, which depends on temperature. I mean, it's not good. Yeah? But if you do everything correctly, keep all the lambdas where they should be, fantastic. Because now you see that the final result for the, yeah? Hat dich deine Begeisterung hinweggeschwemmt, hinweggezogen. Okay, so if you see this, take the logarithm, ne, in order to get the pressure or the logarithm of the partition function, what we always need to compute. Then you see at the end of the day, log is, this guy is minus 3/2, sum over k. No, this is basically 3 times the scalar guy. 3 times the scalar guy, but now an extra term, minus 1/2. There's another particle in your system, which with this mass m over square root of lambda. Ne? So this is the standard partition, log of partition function of massive vector particle. massive vector field. 3 spin degrees of freedom, plus 0 and minus 1. Plus 1, 0, minus 1. This is the log of partition function for neutral scalar field of mass m over square root of lambda, obviously. So there is an extra contribution to the thermodynamics. However, this mass goes to infinity as lambda goes to 0. So that means you basically cannot thermally excite these particles. Infinitely heavy particles, they are not excited. And then there is nothing left. No boson is left of this. Cannot, infinitely heavy particles cannot be thermally excited. No contribution to thermodynamics. Of course, another way to see this is when you do the Matsubara sum as standard, then you remember you get E k lambda over 2 minus log 1 minus e to the minus E k lambda over t, the standard bosonic result. But if the mass goes to infinity, this factor goes to 0, independent of momentum. And then the log of 1 is 0. And the only thing you have to worry about is a 0-point energy contribution, which you have to renormalize anyway. This is infinite, so this has to be renormalized. This will also not contribute. So indeed, this whole thing will not contribute. Okay, so this is also nicely physically interpretable, this result. We introduced an extra degree of freedom on account of the Stückelberg trick, but at the end of the day, we got rid of it again, sending lambda to 0 and get the standard result. And somehow this calculation is a little more, it's easier than the one where you introduce the projections and the n's and the m and stack them together and at the end get the right result. But okay, no matter what you do, if you didn't make a mistake, you will also get the correct answer. Okay, so far, so good. Then let's go to the electromagnetic field. This should be very familiar to you, what I'm presenting. You will just see this again now in the next iteration, so to speak. So this is a massive vector field. Sorry, it's a massless vector field. So the Lagrangian is the standard one from electromagnetism. F mu nu is the field strength tensor as usual. Okay. A mu is my gauge field. Okay, the equations of motion. I mean, this is the same as for the massive vector without the mass term. So you get del mu F mu nu equals 0. This is, of course, Maxwell equation in the absence of sources. Since we don't have any matter field at the moment, in absence of sources of charge. So let's say in absence of charges. Remember, in the massive case, we had another plus m squared v nu or so, but this is now 0, this term. It's just Maxwell's equations. And the canonically conjugate fields, I mean, this repeats the same calculation as before. Pi u is the time derivative of a mu. Okay, but this is minus f0 mu as before. I mean, we always write down the same stuff. Yeah? 0 minus e, which is 0 minus pi. Pi is the canonically conjugate field to a vector. Okay. And you see, aha, cyclic variable a0 is not independent. Mm-hmm. But this is not the only thing, né? Because the electromagnetic field has, of course, two instead of three independent degrees of freedom. It's transverse. So it doesn't have a zero component of spin. It only has plus or minus spin projection. You would call this a helicity or so, né? Or plus or minus transverse polarization, if you like. Plus or minus polarization. Okay. So A0 is not independent, and another component of A vector is also not independent. Which one is up to you? You have to just do it in a way that the physical degrees of freedom are the ones which are transverse to the direction of propagation of the electromagnetic wave. No? As usual, no? You have always transverse waves, no longitudinal waves. Okay. So, in another way of saying this is that there is still a gauge degree of freedom. You can still do gauge transformations to see this redundancy in the components of A mu. So. Degrees of freedom, DOFs. So here this means A0 is cyclic. Okay, good. Or not independent. Naja, not an independent degree. Okay. So, gauge transformations allow you to eliminate another component. So let me first write down the gauge transformation for the electromagnetic fields, of course, well known to you. You can always add a four gradient of some scalar field. Let me call it alpha in this case. Most of the time I call it lambda. I think I can also call it lambda, why not? Yeah, so you can always change A mu by the gradient of a scalar field lambda. So I can also choose. So this A0, this A0 is cyclic. In principle, remember, in the quantum field theory class, we choose the temporal axial gauge, which allows you to eliminate A0, to set A0 to zero from the beginning. I'm not going to do this here. I choose a spatial axial gauge. But okay. This is a technical thing which simplifies the discussion. You could do it in any gauge you like. So choose lambda such that the gauged, which one? Let's take the third, the z component, to be equal to zero, which means that the lambda has to be chosen such that its z derivative equals the old z component. So you want this to be zero, the mu equal 3, 0, that means these guys have to be equal. So if you have an old A3, pick your lambda such that the gradient in z direction of lambda But actually, it's minus z. If you look closely, this is minus the lower 3 minus the gradient in z direction of lambda equals to this field everywhere. Can be done. If I give you an A, I just choose my lambda such that this is fulfilled. The new A, the A prime, has no z component. Yeah, in principle, you can solve this even. Lambda of x is an integral from some point z naught to z dz prime of az or a3 of tx y z prime plus a constant which does not depend on z. If you take the z derivative of this, you end up with a3 at z. So this means I fix the gauge. This is gauge condition is not temporal axial gauge, but spatial axial gauge. Let me just call it axial gauge. In principle, it's a spatial axial gauge. And we have discussed this. We have discussed general axial gauges. General axial gauge is n mu. A mu equals 0, and n mu is some vector, some fixed vector. Here, this vector has only a z component. Okay. So now, this is cyclic. We will see what happens, what we will do with the A0. It's not independent. A3 is eliminated. So only A1 and A2 remain. Those are the physical degrees of freedom. A1, A2, actually prime, A1 prime and A2 prime. But now I can already drop the prime. Otherwise, yeah. Remain. As independent DOFs, degrees of freedom, and they correspond to the two transverse polarization degrees of freedom of the electromagnetic field. Very good. So, that was great. then, of course, there are canonically conjugate fields. So, pi I is minus, so pi lower I is minus E upper I, because pi upper I is plus E upper I. If you like, this is also minus pi upper I. What is this? It's del I A0 minus del 0 AI. Because this is FI0, or minus F0I. As before, and then you can write this really in a three-space language as plus a upper I dot. This del 0 a lower I is minus a del 0 a upper I. So this holds for I equal 1 and 2. Those are the fields, the true fields, canonically conjugate fields corresponding to the physical fields, a1 and a2. And then there's a0 that still floats around. It's a cyclic variable, a0. And pi 3. A3 is 0, but the canonically conjugate field, pi 3, is not 0. I mean, by choosing a gauge, of course, I can eliminate A3, but there's still a pi 3 floating around, if you like. Because pi 3 equals minus E3, those guys are still in the business, but they are not independent. This is, depends on other things, and this also depends on other things. The independent ones are A1, A2, and the associated pi 1, pi 2. And these guys can be eliminated using the equation of motion. And we have to do this also when we compute age, ne? And things like that. Equations of motion. Okay. These guys, again, I mean, referring to the discussion we had previously, at the moment we're not integrating over quantum fields. No? In the partition function, we will eventually have to integrate over the quantum fields. At this point, we're just worrying about formulating the Hamilton density in terms of independent degrees of freedom. And this is done on a classical level, as I tried to explain before. Yeah? So this is all, no? These relations are all classical. This is a classical relation. This is pi in terms of some gradients of A, of the gauge field. No? So at this level, everything can be done using equations of motion. Okay, and later on we will integrate over the quantum fields, but only over the physical quantum fields. The pi 1, pi 2, and the a 1, a 2. No? This is the only fields that you integrate over in the partition function, like in the generating functional for quantum field theory. And all the dependent stuff that will be eliminated using equations of motion. So how can I do this? Okay, let's first worry about this E3 here. No? Equations of motion. So the zeroth component of the Maxwell equation looks like this. No? Zero equals this. And of course, mu equals zero vanishes because F0, 0 is zero. So this is just del I Fi, 0. But this is also simply Fi 0 upper I, 0 is, is plus EI. So this is basically divergence of E. Okay? Okay, this you know. This is Gauss' law. No? Gauss' law. Usually in Gauss' law, there is a charge density here. No? But in the absence of charge densities, this is zero. So Gauss' law in our meta-free discussion of electromagnetic fields, the Gauss' law has a zero on the right-hand side, or left-hand side. Okay. So now I can use this to eliminate E3, no? Because this is also del 1 E1 plus del 2 E2 plus del 3 E3. Okay? So I can solve this for del 3 E3, which is minus del 1 E1 plus minus del 2 E2. Okay. But E1 and E2 are related to the pi. No? I can write this as plus del 1 pi 1 plus del 2 pi 2 if I use the lower index at the pi. No? And these are independent fields. These are the canonically conjugate fields to A1, A2. So everything is good here. No? Those will be degrees of freedom. And later in the quantum language, there will be quantum degrees of freedom, which I integrate over. So I use the same trick as up here, no, to write E3 now as a solution of this differential equation. It's basically, again, an integral over z prime from z0 to z, dz prime. D3 derivative with respect to z, so I integrate over z of the left-hand side, of the right-hand side, so it's the del 1 pi 1 t x y z prime plus del 2 pi 2 of t x y z prime plus a constant which does not depend on z. I call this constant c sub e. This was f. This is t c sub e. So this is, in principle, an explicit formula for the E3 field. Later on, you will see that we will not need this, but this is just to demonstrate that it's absolutely possible to compute Ups, sorry. Gab das einen Schlag eben? Weiß ich nicht. Vermutlich schon, aber okay. Gut, okay. Okay, let's try this. So, only 5 minutes, ne? Okay. So, it just serves to show you that in principle you can compute it explicitly using independent degrees of freedom. So, from the knowledge of the independent degrees of freedom, you compute E3 or Pi3, which was not an independent degree of freedom. So you can explicitly eliminate it, if you like. We will not do it in this form later on, but it's just to, as I said, to show you that it works. And then another integration gives you A0. Because remember, E3 minus pi lower 3 is also, by the definition of pi, or E, del 0 A lower 3 minus del 3 A 0, which is F 03. Ne? Compare here. Ne? Plus E3 is plus F0i lower indices, F03 lower indices. But by choice of gauge, this is 0. Okay? So this is all that remains. Sorry. So D3A0 is minus E3. Okay? So you see, you can insert this equation for E3 and integrate again with respect to Z. So in principle, A0 of x is now minus an integral dz prime of E3 of t x, y, and z prime, plus some constant, which I call C sub A, t x, y. And now you can also, if you like, I have this formula here. I will put it in the script, but it's not so important now. Here you can put this formula in with the appropriate change of indices. No? So this z prime here is on the left. Then this must be z prime, and this must be z double prime. No? But in principle, you can write this out. And you have an explicit elimination of A0 in terms of pi 1 and pi 2. Okay? So you got rid of everything. Everything that depends on something. Okay? And then, of course, these constants can be chosen once you know, if you know this field at Z0, E3 at Z0, that means upper boundary is same as lower boundary, integral is 0. So E3 of T, X, Y, and Z0 is precisely this constant here. So you can also determine this. And the same holds here. No? A0 of t, x, y, and z0 is precisely the other constant. So then you have fixed everything. You completely fix the gauge, in other words. No? Complete gauge fixing. Only the physical degrees of freedom are left. And all the unphysical degrees have been eliminated. Okay. And what we will do on Friday is then to compute the Hamilton density. Ne? Maybe I'll give you the first line so you see where the journey will go. Ne? The Hamilton density is H0. Yeah. Of course, you only Legendre transform with respect to the physical degrees of freedom, because all the unphysical ones have been eliminated. Okay, at the end of the day, AI dot is, of course, pi lower I minus gradient of A naught. This is as before. We had, yeah, we can also write minus pi I. No? But only for 1 and 2, no? The dots of A1 dot and A2 dot. I equals 1, 2. All the other stuff that may appear has been explicitly expressed in terms of pi 1 and pi 2. Okay, so we don't need to worry about it. And this calculation we will then do on Friday. Very simple result. And then I will show you how to compute the partition function. And you'll see all the gory details with the Fadeev-Popov trick. We will see this again, of course. Right, for the gauge field, it must be like that. Okay, let's quit for today. And see you on Friday.